You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Brian Platzer.
Authors, I have a fantastic new service to tell you about. It's called PubSite. PubSite is a service to help you build your very own website, your home on the web, where you can promote your work and give your fans a place to connect with you. PubSite is a website platform that allows every author, regardless of budget, to have a great-looking professional website. Developed by the book marketing professionals at FSB Associates, PubSite is the new easy-to-use DIY website builder developed specifically for books and authors. Whether you're an author of one book or 20, or a small publisher, PubSite allows you to build, design, and most importantly, update your website pain-free. No need to be dependent on a designer or webmaster to make a small but costly change to your website. Save the money and do it yourself. PubSite is the best platform for authors because it's a book-centric platform. PubSite was built just for authors and small publishers. Every design, feature, and layout is book-centric. They have customized designs for you to use. It's easy to build. No coding or HTML is necessary to create a stunning, professional-looking website with all the features you want. Get a custom domain name, yourname.com. It's simple to update. You can add all of your books, add a blog and a book tour, sell from any retailer, manage your email list and social media, and even do e-commerce. Build your website with a 14-day free trial, then pay just $19.99 per month, which includes hosting. And we offer packages starting at $499 to set up the website for you. Pub-site.com, the place to help authors find their home on the web. The Feisty Heroine Romance Collection of Short Stories. Over 30 plus pulse racing shorts to capture your heart with USA Today, The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and award-winning authors in the mix. Paranormal, contemporary, fantasy, and historical romance that will whet your appetite with titillating, heart-pounding tales you'll want to read again, then beg for more. Fall in love with your next book crush. Pre-order this amazing collection of shorts, over 30 pulse-pounding stories, for only 99 cents.
Proceed with caution. Buying this collection may lead to addictive reading, falling in love with your next book crush, and staying up past your bedtime to see what happens next.
Get your limited edition copy of Feisty Heroines. Look for the link in the show notes of this episode. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have Constance Sayers on the show with me. She's got a fantastic new fantasy book that we were just talking about it, how that it completely breaks all the molds of what you expect in a fantasy book. And I love it so much. I think you guys really need this for your bookshelf. Welcome to the show, Constance.
Oh, thank you for having me, Hank. It's really exciting to, I look at all the authors that you've had on the show. It's really an honor to be here.
Well, thank you. I'm excited to have you. Constance, we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Well, I do think I need to stage set just a bit, if you'll indulge me for a second. I had a really odd upbringing. My parents, so I'm 51, my parents were kind of older when they had me. Now it's not a big deal. But back then, they were 41 years old. My dad was 41 and my mom was 39. And so this is back in 1968, and that just didn't happen. My brother was 18 years older than me, and my sister was 11 years older. And my brother actually went off to Vietnam when I was about 1971. And so my dad was a minister, and he left the church, and that doesn't really happen either, you know. And so usually it's a calling, and people don't leave it. And he went back to school to become a teacher, and he became my junior high school principal. So, you know, he was kind of a, you know, he was a minister, he was a preacher. It was, none of that was really good when you're like a teenager. And he actually went blind around the age of 50 and of severe macular degeneration. And so our whole family moved to our farm that we had in rural Pennsylvania. And so it was a very strange, like, having parents like that age, like my first memories were they would just plop me in front of the television, and Watergate hearings were like my very first like memory of television, And then The Edge of Night would come on, and my mom was just like, kind of like, she's like, I don't know what to do with this kid, and a little bit. So my dad really wanted me to be a musician. I had some musical talent. I was an okay singer, and they wanted me to be an opera singer or a music teacher, just something involved with music. And so I had piano lessons for 14 years. I mean, music was just very emphasized. My sister had an old Smith Corona Baby Blue typewriter. It was adorable. And she gave it to me, and I just remember falling in love. So this is my first memory of just kind of locking myself in my dad's office and beginning to write on this, or type, I guess, on this typewriter. And I felt so adult about it. And I wish I could tell you that it was some kind of like highbrow writing that I was, writing. But I was a student, as I just told you, I was a student of television. So I began to write a 250-page soap opera treatment. And all I wanted to do was, I always wanted to write for television. That's all I ever wanted to do. And I mean, I kept this soap opera, kind of like at long outline for like years and years of soap opera like storylines, well until I was like 16 or 17 years old, from like the time I was 12. It just was a very, my family was very creative. I mean, it's just my dad would have really wished that I had gone into music. And so I went into college and went in as a music major, and I hated it. I mean, it was very, I was always in these competitions for music. And so, as a teenager, you're like, you're wonderful, you're the best thing. And then the next person who comes along, it's like, you have no talent, go home. And, I didn't, I mean, teenage girls hate themselves. I mean, we really do, and it was just really tough to kind of manage. And then here I was, like, always kind of having this refuge in writing. Like, back in the days with the typewriter, I remember just taking my first English composition class, nothing even like a fan, like a particularly fancy writing course, and just falling in love with it again and really finding my voice there versus finding my voice singing. And that for me was a shift. I changed my major that afternoon and I never looked back. And my parents were not happy with me. My mom still, like, occasionally we get together, my mom will say, "Will you sing?" And she'll cry. And I'm like, "Oh God, I mean." It was kind of a quirky childhood, but I think that fueled a lot of my desire to write. I saw the world a little differently than everyone else. My world wasn't usual like everyone else's was. I had like, very, very different things happening to me. So.
That is a fascinating story. I'm a couple of years younger than you. I was born in 71, and there's something about kids of our generation. The television and us had a very unique relationship, and that's fascinating. And then add the unique family dynamic, and yeah, you're just that's a gumbo of creativity there.
It was a little bit, yeah. It was definitely a really great, I mean, I wouldn't have traded my childhood, I don't think, for anything in the world, because it really was just like, I mean, it was fascinating. It was fascinating to live. It was fascinating to, even in the moment, I remember thinking, God, this is weird, So.
Do you remember what your first introduction to fantasy was?
Well, all along, I mean, I was a big, speaking of television, I was a big Dark Shadows fan, And so, I mean, I just loved anything that just kind of, took me, kind of out of like this kind of realm. And I really was a very big fan of that. And I mean, I love, I was a big Buffy fan. I was a big, I'm all my life, I've just really loved and gravitated toward fantasy television much more so. And Anne Rice, you had Anne Rice on your show not too long ago. And I mean, I remember getting Interview with a Vampire and having it just completely change my life. And I mean, it really changed my life. But I will say this, I never thought about writing fantasy That was just, I was writing things that were very, very, things that were very normal, like, very, very like rural noir, very close, very, like, just very different writing. And I don't think that, my writing kind of got better until I got out of that, and when I, until I started writing fantasy. But, and also probably my favorite Anne Rice book was the Witching Hour.
Gotcha. After taking that creative writing course and your kind of outlook changing, what did you go on to do? Because this is your debut book, right?
Right, it is.
So what have you been doing in the meantime?
Well, I mean, I have an undergraduate degree in writing, and I took a lot of screenwriting and playwriting, and just dabbling in every kind of writing that you could. And then I moved to Washington, D.C. I was born and raised in Pittsburgh, and I moved down to Washington, D.C. in 1993, and I went to George Mason. You had Susan Richards Shreve on not too long ago on your show, and she was my thesis advisor. And at George Mason, and that was just a really great. It was a bit of when I got to George Mason, it was a bit of a Montessori program. Honestly, it was a little like self-design major. And I was working full time, so I do not have an MFA. I have an MA, and because I didn't really want to take, I knew I was going to have to work at night. I mean, do the work at night and work during the day. So I just wanted a quick, really good master's program, and so I self-designed a lot of it. And I did a lot of criticism and Marxist theory, structuralist theory, but then also a lot of fiction writing. So it was a really kind of very interesting program. And I continued to work during the day. So I worked at several marketing jobs, writing marketing copy. A lot of people, that's what we do when we have writing degrees. And then I ended up back in 2000 going to work for Atlantic Media, who owns The Atlantic. And I love publications, I love magazines. And so I was working for, they have a kind of a B2B division, and I was working for that publication. And I'm actually now the president of that division. So I actually have a full, I have a day job.
Nice.
And and did this at night.
Wow.
Wrote the debut novel at night.
You're like, by the way, you're like the fifth person who's told me that they had Susan. They learned under Susan Richards Shreve. That's amazing. She has such a wide reach and has affected so many people.
She's just
That's
amazing.
yeah. It's just fun to hear. While your day job has been focused around writing and communicating, it may seem, on the surface that that is not connected directly to fiction writing, but I love to explore the intersections of things and how things inform other things. Do you feel like the work that you've been doing at your day job has made you more well prepared for this point in time and for writing fiction?
Well, I think that it has made me. I don't think that I would have launched this book without my day job. A couple things about that. The Atlantic is a very unique environment. You work around people who do fantastic things. I mean, in my, Ta-Nehisi Coates worked here. I've got, Jeff Goldberg. You've got some really, really, really good people at the Atlantic. Corby Kummer, who write books and who write regularly. I look around and I see a lot of our writers. They're cranking out 800 to 1,000 word stories a day easily. So you get the sense of there's a pace here, and there's an idea that you can do anything, And then in my side, I'm on the business side of the house, and I think that the thing about the business side of the house is I've developed two publications, two media titles, and from nothing. So there's a lot of creative energy that goes in that, and you see them to finish. Like, that's the thing about that. And I think that that was the one thing that for me became it's a marathon. You've got to know that, that you're a novel is a the process of a novel, the process of writing a novel, the process of the rejection of a novel, the process of the success of a novel is all of it takes metal. And I learned that here. I will say that most of my job now is numbers, not, it used to be words, now it's numbers. That is a help because I couldn't write all day and write all night. So, yeah. But, it prepared me and just taught me that, I just have colleagues that just do extraordinary things. And I was like, well, I can too, And you get that kind of culture. And so it's a, it, and I'm very, very grateful to this job for teaching me that.
Excellent. The new book we've kind of danced around it is called A Witch in Time. This really kind of nails several of my favorite genres in this really cool mashup. I love a time travel story or this story of people that are stuck in time. And then, of course, kind of magical fantasy. What's not to love there? When you started thinking about this book, and we'll kind of break this down for people in just a minute, but who came to you first? Was it Juliette Lecomte or was it Helen Lambert?
It was Helen. Yeah, very, very much Helen. Yeah. And the original, I would say that the original configuration of it was kind of a deathbed confessional from Helen. And so, I mean, anybody who has read the book or starts even reads the first chapter of the book, it's a very, very different story. And I remember, workshopping, so I have an active workshop group, and you're always desperate. It's like, oh my God, do I have like enough pages to take to the you're up next on workshop, and it's like, crap, do I have enough stuff to take? And I had all my short stories. I was through all of those, and I was like, okay, I'll take this like 50 pages of this novel I'm working on just to get their feedback from on it. And I remember taking it, and the writer AX Ahmad, who wrote The Last Taxi Driver, is in the group, and he's been one of my he's just one of my first readers always on anything I do. And he said, Connie, this deathbed confessional thing is horrible. It's just horrible. It's a horrible idea. But he said, like, the lives, because I had Helen and Juliet both in the draft that they saw, and they're like, that's what really comes to life about this. And I said, well, I have other time periods, and they're like, that's what we want to see, is we want to see this character in different time periods. And I remember seeing the other day a piece of paper where I actually did math on it to figure out how old she had to be, and where when I had to start the time period so that I could nail the accuracy of how many lives I was going to have and when they were going to start and finish. So that so definitely it started with Helen, but I didn't I screwed that up. I mean, that wasn't like my first draft on that was pretty bad, but I will say after that it made sense and the draft really took off.
Well, and that's a mistake that a lot of people make is that you finish your first draft and then you start seeing all the problems with it. And that is an opportunity to restructure and take the big chunks that you've got nailed down. And start to see the story. Some people can, do that in one draft and or maybe with a really detailed outline before they start writing. And but I'm kind of like you. Sometimes I have to finish it and then go, oh, now I know what the story is.
And I mean, my first book, my first novel, took me about 10 years to write. And it was a kind of a rural noir book, and there's a mystery. And I mean, I just don't do that very well. People like Joe Clifford and Steph Post do that very well. I don't do that very well. And but the book got me an agent. And for that, I'm grateful. It's and it taught me how to write a book, but it was not my strongest effort. And by contrast, this book, I think I was done with it from start to finish, maybe a year. And so I really thought that it must be horrible. You know what I mean? Because like if it came that easy or it came that, I thought, well, gosh, this must be just dreadful. And so when I started sending it out to people, I have like three or four first readers, they were saying things like, I couldn't put it down, I read it all night. And I was like, really? And because nobody had said that about the first novel, to be very candid. And it might have kept them up all night or put them to sleep, I'm not quite sure. But like that was not what I heard from the first book. And it was just a very different people felt very different about the second book. And so but I did do something with the second book that I did with the first, which is that I hired a former acquisitions editor from one of the publishing houses. I always had her kind of look at it and give me real good advice on the best way to market it and fix it so that it had appeal. And that was very valuable. It was not cheap, but it was something I think was very valuable, and my agent encouraged me to do that. And so by the time we had it packaged to go out for, you know, to kind of for the publishing houses to try and get an editor, I felt like it had been through a lot of different iterations, but what it kept coming back was that people were like, they were hooked and they kind of went through it and they kind of kept saying things like, I can't put it down. And so I was hopeful it would get picked up somewhere, but you never know, you know?
Right. So we'll let the listeners in on the little inside joke there. When I asked you who came first, was it Juliet or was it Helen? Juliet and Helen are the same character.
Right.
Tell us about this this idea of a person who is stuck in time and is continually coming back, not remembering, but then starting to piece together this curse.
Right. So, you know, the concept of it was that that Helen goes out on a date and finds out, you know, with a man who says, we've known each other for 100 years and you call me and, you know, she thinks this man's crazy. But there are things then that start to kind of happen to her that this kind of almost meeting him begins a process for her. And this process for her, she begins having dreams of a woman in France, in the Parisian, you know, kind of the countryside outside of Paris. And it becomes, and she says, like, I'm not seeing this woman, I am this woman. And, you know, so it becomes a way for her to kind of, you know, process the fact that something very weird is starting to happen to her. And she's starting to have some additional abilities that she never had before. And so this man that she went out, you know, with, you know, she goes to him and she says, basically, like, there might be something to this. And so, and what comes out of it is he says, you know, you have to kind of experience this yourself, but you'll experience, you know, Nora and Sandra. And she asks, you know, well, I also see the ghost of, you know, Christmas past too, you know, and so it's got a little bit of like, she's got to experience these lives, but each one of them, I think the hard part, Hank, about writing these characters is that they had to nest. So, you know, Nora has to, you know, by the time the Nora story comes, she has to pick up the knowledge of Juliet and have been changed by it, but yet also remain the fact that this is one essence. And the idea here, I think, is that this is the same woman through many different, like the essence of her is the same, so that by the, you know, the time you get to the when Helen learns her whole complete story, she is complete finally. You know, and I think there are feelings that each one of these women have of being incomplete because they don't have the full grasp of their entire history. So, you know, that's and I think, you know, it's great. It's kind of a ride along the way. You get the beautiful Belle Epoque Paris. And I tried to kind of make the language. I was very much an admirer of David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas, where I thought he really immersed himself into the exact time frame that he was down to the language. And I really wanted to try that and really push myself hard to make sure that you really feel like you are kind of constrained in Belle Epoque France. But then also you've got like the language is very different in Hollywood in the 1930s. And that's kind of, that's a great time for Hollywood. I mean, it's the beginning. It's pre-Hays Code, so it's the beginning of the formation of what would become, you know, the blonde bombshell, the, you know, the femme fatale. I mean, you've got like these great like moments of creation of, and it's a bit of a feminist book too, because it's got these sense of like, this is where the idea of a woman on the cinema kind of was created. And so I had her right there at that kind of, you know, key moment in history, and she's actually a big participant in that. And then I love the 70s. I mean, I'm a child of the 70s. I love the 70s. And that whole kind of idea then of that was kind of a more fluid, you know, kind of groovy time period. And I wanted my character to go through that as well. So you have these different time periods that this woman is kind of coming of age of, and she keeps having to repeat, you know, this, her life. It's almost a little like, like starting a game, you know, like start the game over. And she has to pick up this knowledge as she goes along, and she's evolving, but she's also kind of stuck in the same. It's a little like Run Lola Run, if you've seen that, you know, a couple years ago. I love that movie. So, but it was very fascinating to write.
So what is the mechanism that kicks this off? We've got this young woman in France, Juliette Lecomte, and she gets herself involved with someone, and out of that situation comes this curse that she has to live with for better than 100 years.
So, yeah, so many Parisian painters would come to the countryside of France to, you know, really kind of document the lives of country people. And so you see that in paintings everywhere of that time period. So I wanted to take that, and I wanted to have the idea of a painter who comes from France every summer, and he paints this woman. She's his muse, his young girl, and she's 16 years old. I mean, and so it's a very inappropriate relationship. But she's due to be married next year to the man who owns the farm, their son, and so she's betrothed. And so she, you know, she has ideas that she's kind of older than she is, and she wants to be older than she is, and she wants to be an adult, and she wants to go to France. And so she enters into a very ill-advised relationship with this man, and he, you know, and this painter paints her, and her mother, who is a kind of local witch, finds out about it. And, you know, I mean, at that time, you know, her daughter would have been ruined by this. And so, furious, she, you know, calls upon a demon in over her head, and she essentially binds her daughter to this man. For she was to punish, wanted to punish him for eternity. Well, she binds her daughter to him accidentally. So it's a curse that has gone wrong. And there's another person in the curse as well. And they kind of begin to have a love triangle then through these periods of time. And so that's the mechanism of which the curse you know, kind of propels. I mean, it's got other, you know, the fantasy element is that this curse is the cause of all of this. And, you know, can modern day Helen stop it and not have it happen again?
How fun was it? Because you really nailed the time periods, and you can tell that you took care and research to really get them right. But then to get to add fantastical elements and a little bit of magic, and this demon and the curse that's always kind of hovering over that. How fun is that to weave into such a realistic, historically accurate period?
It was, I'll tell you what, it was. It was at the time, I don't think I realized how big of a job it was. I mean, you know, but you know, the first thing I always it was amazing. But I started with the real historical portions. Like, so I did all of the research that was required for the time period. I was very I wanted you to feel like you were in that. So that was, you know, I mean, a lot of books on, you know, every time period. You know, six or seven really good Belle Epoque books. I read a lot of Zola. I wanted books that were, I read books that were actually created in the time so that the language was appropriate. I did the same thing for Hollywood. I had so many books on Hollywood, run on Carole Lombard and Jean Harlow. And then in the 70s, the creation of the Fleetwood Mac, the two Fleetwood Mac, the White Album and Rumours. So it was a lot of, you know, kind of real honest, solid historical research. But then in every case, I went to somebody. I had a guide from the Louvre take me all around France and tell me every single custom that would have happened back to, you know, in 1895, 1896. And then I had the same thing for Los Angeles. It was really funny. The guide that I had for Los Angeles thanked me for not, he said usually his tours were to Calabasas, to the Kardashians' house. And he said, thank you very much. You know, so I was, he had to look up stuff. We went to all of Carole Lombard's houses. We went to all of Jean Harlow's houses, Thelma Todd. I mean, a lot of really, really cool things because I wanted to, I mean, I felt like I had to see, you know, everything. I studied a lot of costume design of the time. That was very important. The food, all the menus. I mean, so there was a lot of painstaking work that went through to make the realistic element of it, that layer. But then also, you know, I wanted to get the magic right. And so that was, I spent a lot of time with the editors at Hachette to make sure that the magic element was solid. And, you know, there were a couple things that we kind of added at the, that kind of overlaid over the magical about, you know, Juliet's origins and her true origins. That wasn't in the first draft. And so it was, you know, I knew that I wanted this character kind of, you know, evolving through these different time periods, but the magic that propelled her through that required care. And so, I spent probably more time on that than in the latter drafts with the publisher to get that where it needed to be and solid and feel logical. And I think the biggest thing that I wanted, Hank, was not to have, like, I think you can just get in this book and it's not complicated. Do you know what I mean? Like, you pick it up and it's not complicated. The magical system is, but like you figure it out pretty fast, and it's, and you get engrossed in the lives, and I didn't want the mechanism of the magic to kind of stand in the way. I didn't want it to be complicated. And so that, you know, that was something that was very important to me. And then also I didn't want it to be repetitive. And that was the one thing I think that could have really been a problem. So for me, the fun thing is every time I have a book is, there are problems I have to solve. And so what are those problems and how am I going to solve them? You know? And so it's like, okay, how am I going to make this magic? How, you know, how am I going to fit all these time periods? And so you're solving those problems constantly. And I think for me, that's the thing about writing and about fiction writing that I don't think people realize. And so much of it is like, you think on these problems that you have with the narrative and you're trying to figure out, you know, how you can make them, how you can solve them. And so, and this was kind of a big puzzle. The book is definitely a bit of a puzzle.
Well, one thing that I love about this book is as I'm reading it, and, you know, I'm constantly reminded of Juliet, even as she comes into these different iterations of herself. And it gives me a sense of there's a bit of a redemption story going on here.
Right.
Even that when she doesn't realize that she's in need of a redemption, and that, you know, of someone who is coming to grips with who they are and are they, in control of their destiny, you know, so to speak. And, you know, when we come to this great culmination, at the end, and I don't want to give away too much, but, we as readers are rewarded for, investing in her. Was that something that was a conscious, you know, thought in your mind as you're telling her different iterations?
Yeah, I definitely, you know, and Helen's the kind of the architect then of the ultimate, you know, I mean, or will she, or will she not have the ultimate, you know, redemption. And for Helen, what is the burden that she bears for all of these, all of, you know, all the mistakes that each of these women have made, and they all have made some of them to some degree. But yes, the ultimate redemption story. I mean, you know, I mean, I feel like Juliet, you know, I think there's a tendency maybe to be a little hard on her, but she's a child, you know, and she's a child and she's an impulsive, impetuous, poor decision-making child. I mean, she's a teenager. And
who of us would want to be haunted by the choices we made then for the rest of eternity?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I do think that there's, and one thing that just fascinated me as I was writing the book, and I do say this when Helen goes back to Juliet's home, is the burden that you would have. I mean, we're not supposed to live 150 years. We're not supposed to, you know, I mean, like naturally that it's just unnatural to see that much history, you know, the expanse of history. We're supposed to be a little bit more contained than that in our lives. And so what is it if you have seen so much? If you're a person who lives in modern day Washington and yet you have seen Paris in 1895, what does that do to you? You know, and I think that that was, to me, was a very fascinating thing about that, you know, you can construct a time travel novel and you can, but what does it do to you? You know, and I really was concerned about portraying that on the page and what happens when you assemble all these lives and how are you forever changed? And I wanted Helen to have that experience and then figure out if she could, in fact, break the curse, because Helen was the first character that actually really fit and felt comfortable in her life and fought for her life. And so, you know, you don't have that always with most of them. You know, I mean, there was some, you know, there was a little bit, maybe Nora a little bit, but, you know, certainly Juliet and Sandra, I mean, they were conflicted in their times. They were, you know, I mean, I think it does kind of take a harsh look at the way women were treated in France. You know, they were chattel. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I mean, you know, Juliet understands what her options are. At one point, they're spelled out for her very carefully. And she has a real concern that she's, you know, being, you know, possibly like when she goes to work for Lucien Barnier, she's very concerned that she's being basically sent to be a prostitute. And, you know, I mean, I wanted that time period to be beautiful, but also to feel as constrained as a corset. I mean, it's constraining. Women didn't have a lot of options. You know, women in France at that point couldn't, if they were a real lady, could not walk unchaperoned on the streets. You know, so I wanted to kind of feel that and make those, you know, she was very constrained in what she could do. And then you had Nora kind of taking on the burden of, you know, this idea of the ideal woman. I mean, that was a, you know, at a time period. So there are just real things about, you know, each one of these and, you know, time periods that I think speak to the different situations of women. You know, you had the 70s, you know, much more free love, you know, but was it, you know, I mean, you know, so I think that there are definitely some things that I try to ask and answer a little bit about each, you know, woman's time frame. But I think that with Helen, she's the first woman who actually is comfortable in her time frame. And
Constance, I love this book so much. I love the world that you've built. Will we ever see anything else from this world in the future?
I am working right now on a second book that is not a sequel, but it has an element of one tiny element of this book, but it's a very different, it's a standalone book, and it's about a dark circus in 1925 in Paris. So it's featuring the kind of the lost generation of Paris. And so you've got, you know, kind of this circus, you know, going on while you've got Hemingway and Fitzgerald and folks like that living in Paris at the time. So, and it has a modern day kind of story as well. So that's what I'm working on right now.
Fantastic. The book is called A Witch in Time. It's available everywhere now from our friends at Hachette in hardcover and Kindle edition, also an audiobook. I haven't listened to the audiobook of this yet, but I'm about to put it in my Audible queue because I want to read this again and I want to hear someone else read it to me.
That's amazing.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
They have four actresses actually playing the four different roles. That's very cool. Yeah, that was really great.
Love it. I love it. Constance, if people are just discovering you and want to dig into all the great stuff that you do, is there a place they can connect with you online?
Absolutely. I'm at constancesayers.com. That's C-O-N-S-T-A-N-C-E, Sayers, S-A-Y-E-R-S.com. And that's also on Twitter at Constance Sayers or on Instagram at Constance Sayers as well.
I love it. We'll put links to all of that great stuff in the show notes of this episode. Constance, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Stay tuned now for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Fox's The Ember War.
The near future. The probe slowed as the sun's heliosphere disrupted the graviton wave it rode in on from the abyss of deep space. Awakened by the sudden deceleration, the probe absorbed the electromagnetic spectrum utilized by its target species and assessed the technological sophistication of the sole sentient species on Earth. The probe adjusted its course to take it into the system's primary. If the humans couldn't survive, with its help, what was to come, then the probe would annihilate itself. There would be no trace of it for the enemy, and no chance of humanity's existence beyond the time it had until the enemy arrived. The probe analyzed filed patents, military expenditures, birth rates, mathematical advancement, and space exploration. The first assessment fell within the margin of error of survival and extinction for humanity. The probe's programming allowed for limited, autonomous decision-making,
choice being a rare luxury for the probe's class of artificial intelligence. The probe found itself in a position to choose between ending its mission in the sun's fire and a mathematically improbable defense of humanity, and the potential compromise of its much larger mission. Given the rare opportunity to make its own decision, the probe opted to dither. In the week it took to pass into Jupiter's orbit, the probe took in more data. It scoured the internet for factors to add to the assessment, but the assessment remained the same. Unlikely, but possible. By the time it shot past Mars, the probe still hadn't made a decision. As the time to adjust course for Earth or continue into the sun approached, the probe conducted a final scan of cloud storage servers for any new information, and found something interesting. While the new information made only a negligible impact on the assessment, the probe adjusted course to Earth. It hadn't traveled all this way for nothing. In the desert south of Phoenix, Arizona, it landed with no more fanfare than a slight thump and a few startled cows. Then it broke into the local cell network and made a call. Mark Ibarra awoke to his phone ringing at max volume, playing a pop ditty that he hated with vehemence. He rolled off the mattress that lay on the floor and crawled on his hands and knees to where his cell was recharging. His roommate, who paid the majority of their rent and got to sleep on an actual bed, grumbled and let off a slew of slurred insults. Mark reached his cell and slapped at it until the offending music ended. He blinked sleep from his eyes and tried to focus on the caller's name on the screen. The only people who'd call at this ungodly hour were his family in Basque country, or maybe Jessica in his applied robotics course wanted a late-night study break. The name on the screen was Answer Me. He closed an eye and reread the name. It was way too early, or too late, depending on one's point of view, for this nonsense. He turned the ringer off and went back to bed. Sleep was about to claim him when the phone rang again, just as loudly as last time, but now with a disco anthem.
Seriously?
His roommate slurred. Mark declined the call and powered the phone off. He flopped back on his bed and curled into his blanket.
To hell with my first class, he thought.
Arizona State University had a lax attendance policy, one which he'd abused for nights like this. The cell erupted with big band music. Mark took his head out from beneath the covers and looked at his phone like it was a thing possessed. The phone vibrated so hard that it practically danced a jig on the floor, and the screen flashed Answer Me over and over again as music blared.
Dude,
said his roommate, now sitting up in his bed. Mark swiped the phone off the charging cord, and the music stopped. The caller's name undulated with a rainbow of colors, and an arrow appeared on the screen, pointing to the button he had to press to answer the call.
When did I get this app? He thought.
Mark sighed and left the bedroom, meandering into the hallway bathroom with the grace of a zombie. The battered mattress he slept on played hell with his back and left him stiff every morning. Dropping his boxers, he took a seat on the toilet and answered the call, determined to return this caller's civility with some interesting background noise.
What?
He murmured. Mark Ibarra, I need to see you. The voice was mechanical, asexual in its monotone.
Do you have any friggin' idea what time it is? Wait, who the hell is this?
You must come to me immediately. We must discuss the mathematical proof you have stored in document title This Can't Be Right. Doc.
Mark shot to his feet. The boxers around his ankles tripped him up, and he stumbled out of the bathroom and fell against the wall. His elbow punched a hole in the drywall, and the cell clattered to the floor. He scooped the phone back up and struggled to breathe as a sudden asthma attack came over him.
How?
He couldn't finish his question until he found his inhaler in the kitchen, mere steps away in the tiny apartment. He took a deep breath from the inhaler and felt the tightness leave his lungs. That someone knew of his proof was impossible. He'd finished it earlier that night and had encrypted it several times before loading it into a cloud file that shouldn't have been linked to him in any way.
How do you know about that?
He asked. You must come to me immediately. There is little time. Look at your screen, the robotic voice said. His screen changed to a map program, displaying a pin in an open field just off the highway, connecting Phoenix to the suburb of Maricopa. Come. Now. Mark grabbed his keys. An hour later, his jeans ripped from scaling a barbed wire fence, Mark was surrounded by desert scrub. The blue of the morning rose behind him, where his beat-up Honda waited on the side of the highway. With his cell to...
Some things you write now, do they differ in the writing process from...
Plants looked a lot like benign mesquite trees in the darkness. A Native American casino in the distance served as his North Star, helping him keep his bearings.
You're not out here, are you? I'm being punked, aren't I?
He asked the mysterious caller. You are 9.26 meters to my east-southeast. Punk, decayed wood, used as tinder. Are you on fire? The caller said. Mark rolled his eyes. This wasn't the first time the caller had used the non-standard meanings of words during what passed as conversation between the two. Mark had tried to get the caller to explain how he knew about his theorem and why they had to meet in the middle of the desert. The caller had refused to say anything. He would only reiterate that Mark had to come quickly to see him, chiding him every time Mark deviated from the provided driving directions.
If you're so close, why can't I see you? He asked.
He took a few steps in what he thought was a northwesterly direction and squished into a cow patty.